Our brain really prioritizes vocal signals. They're super important to the brain because human communication is a really big priority for us as a species. So
the scream, for instance, would really make an impression. I mean, yeah. I imagine it's probably similar to hearing your baby cry. Mm-hmm. Like, these are things in, like, you know, you got to take care of that.
Yes. It's a deep signal in our brain, right? And so we were seeing a stronger reaction, to the screams than to music. And that sort of makes sense. And there were more intricacies to that, but I can't really remember the exact brain areas and all that. But it was cool to see that, it is sort of mimicking, but our brain really separates them. You know, it may still get sort of a response, a same kind of fearful response, but it's not going to be as powerful as the voice, which makes sense because music is not real, right? Like, there's a difference between a real stimuli and sort of this artistic one. Yeah. So it was interesting.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Caitlin Trevor. My next guest is an award-winning researcher and musician with over a decade of experience studying how people perceive and respond to sound. She holds a PhD in music theory from The Ohio State University and has published her work in top journals. She was awarded a Marie Skidowska Curry Fellowship to study music and neuroscience and is professionally certified in user research. As a musician, she has a master's in cello performance, composed an award-winning short film score, and designed sound for theater and film. At Sonic UXR, she leads with both credibility and creative empathy, equipping sound teams with the tools to create more intentional, impactful audio. Her name is Caitlin Trevor, and her work is reshaping how sound is understood, valued, and designed across industries. If you've ever wondered how sound really works on us, this conversation will change the way you listen. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available, along with some other interesting bits of audio-related news. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with Caitlin Trevor. Welcome, Caitlin. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to this because I have not spoken to a researcher that is a woman in a really long time.
Oh, wow.
And I would love to get more of your perspective on things in general, definitely where sound is taking us. But before we get there, I want to sort of get a little bit of background on you. And I want to ask you if you have an early memory of how sound moved you.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here. Yes, I do have a really strong memory. It was so random. I was babysitting somebody. This is back when I was in, like, I think seventh grade. And it was this older kid, so we were kind of just hanging out. You know, it was like easy, chilling. And I came across on the floor like a little cassette tape and a cassette player, and I popped it in and just hit play while we were chatting, and it was the Lord of the Rings soundtrack, and I hadn't heard it before. You know, I hadn't seen Lord of the Rings. I was a little too young when it came out, the first one, and I was just captivated by it. I mean, I was like, wow, what is this? I hadn't really heard much orchestral music before that, and it just totally lit a fire in me. Like, I became completely obsessed with movie soundtracks after that.
How old were you then?
I think I was around 13. I must have been a little, okay. I was thinking 12, but that seems pretty young for babysitting. I must have been 13.
Oh, I don't know. I started when I was 11.
Okay.
I mean.
Maybe it was 12.
Up to the parents.
Yeah. So But yeah, I was, because I started playing cello at age 11, so I was already interested in orchestra, but I hadn't listened to it as an outsider much yet. And that was different, you know, and at that level, right? Like, I mean, when I started orchestra, nobody's very good. So hearing, like, you know, a professional orchestra was like, whoa. I mean, that really blew my mind. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Lord of the Rings is a good place to start, too.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Epic soundtrack. Epic.
Yeah. Did you end up watching those movies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I'm a big fan. And I love the soundtracks. And I got to see the Chicago Symphony Orchestra play them live in Chicago with the film, which was so cool. Yeah. Really, really great memory.
Wow. Yeah. That does sound like it would be a mind-blowing experience.
Mm-hmm. The percussion section is incredible. I mean, they have so much percussion in that soundtrack. So it was just gigantic. Like, so many people back there. It was really cool.
I can only imagine. I've never seen it live myself. But yeah, the movies, I mean, it just transports you, mm-hmm. which I guess is the point. A lot of this, right? I'm sure we're going to talk about that in more detail in just a bit here. but yeah, music really has that way of bringing us into another space, putting mm-hmm. us in another mindset, you know, just changing things.
Yeah.
So
I think that's what I loved so much about soundtracks, especially because the whole point of a movie soundtrack is to affect you emotionally. And it's amazing at that because it has to do it without you even knowing, you know, it has to just kind of work on you in the background. So I still love listening to movie soundtracks and just letting them affect my emotions. Just letting it kind of wave over me is just really special. Yeah.
Yeah. And it works so well.
It really does.
Yeah. So from cello to academia, like, because mm-hmm. you have a PhD, right?
Yes. Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I started playing cello. I played piano before when I was 5 or so I started. So it was nice when I started cello. I already knew how to read music, which was a huge plus. And then, yeah, I went to college for music. I was doing cello, but it was a BA, so I had some freedom and I was learning music theory. I'd never heard of music theory before. This was new. And then there was a lecture I went to totally by chance. Because I was an RA, you know, a resident assistant. And so I had to get involved in the campus life. And so I was like, okay, let's go check out this music lecture. Sure. And it was a new music theory professor. And the lecture was about music cognition. And I'd never heard of it before. And I was like, this is just the coolest field I've ever heard of. And I totally was on board after that. I went up to him after the talk and I told him, I was like, I would really like to do this field. And he became my mentor, Joe Plazak. He was an amazing professor. And he went to Ohio State for his PhD and he worked with David Huron. So then he was really encouraging me to do the same. And at first I thought he was just biased. I'm like, oh, wow, you went there. It's your old mentor, maybe I'll check it out, you know. Like, and then I was at a conference in Toronto. It was my first conference ever in music cognition, and I saw David Huron speak at the conference. I was like, oh, actually, he's amazing. I want to work with this man. I mean, he was such a good storyteller. And so I remember, I could barely get in the room. It was packed. And when I went in there, yeah, he just captivated the audience from start to finish in a way that I hadn't seen any other presenter do. So, yeah, I really wanted to work with him, and I was lucky enough to get accepted there. So I went to Ohio State for almost five years to do my PhD there. Yeah.
I love that this was in Toronto. Was that was that where they were studying this, or was there a particular reason it was there?
No, it was just SMPC. It's the Society for Music Perception and Cognition. The conference moves around. It depends
who hosts
it. So that
just happened to be where it was.
Yeah, Toronto. Toronto is a good center of music cognition research. So it tends to end up at a university that has a good music cognition program. So Toronto,
does U of T have one of those?
I can't remember if it's U of T
or York. It might be York.
I think it was U of T. I can't remember. Sorry.
Yeah, it's totally okay. I'm just thrilled that, you know, my hometown is like hosting these things. I think that's so cool. So you went from music cognition mm-hmm. and then academia to industry? Like, what did you do after that? Because I know you have your own company right now, right?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's there's a bit more to the path. I finished my PhD in 2018. And then I got a Marie Curie fellowship to do a postdoc in Switzerland, in Zurich. So I moved to Zurich and I was working in a neuroscience department for...
That's a big change.
A while. Yes, it was.
How was that?
It was amazing. I mean, I really loved Switzerland. Yeah, it's an incredible place. Just gorgeous. I mean, it was one of those places where as you walked through it, you were like, is this really real or am I maybe in heaven? Did I die? I don't know. Like, you know,
did they get better at AI before I knew it?
Yeah, it was just wild. Like the Lake Zurich is like crystal clear. And then behind it, you see the Alps. And then there's also like swans drifting by. You're like, this is not real. This can't be real.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
So it was amazing. It was intimidating, though. I mean, doing neuroscience, like I started learning a bit in my PhD, but I was still very new to everything neuroscience. But it was really great. It was fascinating to learn how to scan brains and analyze the data. And I had the chance to really step up my game with like programming and statistics, because coming from music, if you're in music cognition and you came from music, usually you're weaker on those skills, as opposed to psych people who go into music cognition. They're really great at those and they have to figure out how music kind of works if they don't play music. So yeah, I'm on that side of things. And so yeah, I finished the postdoc in Switzerland. And then my husband and I moved to Birmingham, UK. That's where we live now, 3 years ago. And at first I was a teaching fellow at the University of Birmingham. It was actually really good timing because my husband was offered a professorship there, a full-time professorship in psychology. So that's why we were moving there. And they just happened to have a one-year position for someone to teach music cognition and music and emotion. It was perfect.
Wow. That is quite the coincidence.
It was extremely lucky. In academia, it can be so hard to go to the same place, you know, at the same
time. Is music cognition something that is a big field? Like, it seems to me like it would be very, very, very focused.
Yeah.
And yet, like, it seems to be everywhere.
It's pretty niche. Yeah. I mean, in the United States, it's sort of a niche within the field of music theory. So my PhD is technically in music theory, but there is a group of people within music theory who focus on music cognition. And then across the world, yeah, it's a bit more varied. You know, sometimes there's psych labs who are really interested in music because they're part of the community. Sometimes you have kind of outliers, like people from like film, multimedia type of background who get interested in music cognition.
Yeah, even advertising.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, sometimes advertising. Also like music information retrieval. So this is getting more technical, kind of acoustic analyses and this sort of thing. So yeah, there's sort of these offshooting fields that all intersect in the same place.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Toman, CEO of Augie Studio and host of Founder at 50, and you're listening to the Audio Branding Podcast. Subscribe now, because even a 50-year-old tech industry veteran like me can still learn more about the power of sound and audio.
In Switzerland, I was extremely lucky that there happened to be like one lab at the whole university that was voice and music with neuroscience. But yeah, it was hard to find a lab to work at because it is really small.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from the fellowship or the Birmingham to what? Like, and is your husband still a professor there?
Yes. Yes, he is.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So, and then you went out on your own.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So I had my daughter. That's how I ended kind of my career in academia. It was a big life shift, huge chapter change.
That's huge. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so I had her and I left the fellowship to have her, you know, the teaching position. And yeah, after I had her, you know, I mean, of course, when you have a kid, you go through like a huge brain shift of, you know, you totally look at your life differently and your future and your goals change and everything. So I had been thinking for a while of leaving academia, partly for practical reasons. My husband's an academic. It's really hard to be married to an academic and get jobs in the same place.
My husband almost got a PhD in philosophy. I know of what you speak.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Yes.
So, yeah. So it was always kind of on the table. Like, one of us is probably going to have to leave at some point. And I was curious about outside of academia. All I'd known was academia at that point. I didn't know how industry worked. I didn't know how companies worked much. I worked like a tiny bit. I did a little internship back in the day in a costume designing company, which was really cool. But that was it. That's all I had. So I had my daughter. I was off for a while, you know, and so I was just looking into what exists out there, and I found UX research, and that really seemed interesting to me. I liked the idea of using research to improve experiences, improve products, and ideally make people's lives better, because that's something that drew me to industry also, is I didn't like that my research was so niche and didn't feel connected to the world. You know, it was really fun for me. I loved what I researched. I researched mostly, I didn't really mention what I researched. I researched music and emotion mostly.
Should have asked.
That's okay.
Yes.
I
go ahead.
I skipped along as I went through my journey.
Yeah. We'll get there.
Yeah. Mostly music and emotion. I mean, kind of things tangential to that, but that was always the heart of it, because as I said before, that's what fascinated me about movie scores, is that they affect your emotions so much. And so I wanted to know, how does that work? How do you do that? And in Switzerland, I also studied music and emotion, but I specialized in horror film soundtracks, which was really fun.
Yeah.
So I looked at music
and
fear.
Yeah, that was interesting.
That's part of why I went to that lab, because they were studying screams and how they're processed in the brain, and that fits really well with horror film music. So it was a nice pairing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, what did they discover?
I mean, part of their work was really focused on trying to localize in the brain the areas that are responding to emotion and voice, and emotion and music, which I can't really speak to those results much because I'm still a little uncomfortable with neuroscience. But I did, what I was looking at was, I was curious how much music is copying the voice in order to communicate emotions and evoke emotions. It's sort of a thing that's looked at a lot in music and emotion, is that parallel between the voice and music, and how much do those overlap? Are they kind of the same code that's being sent to the brain? And what I liked about horror film music is it's the closest, like scary music is the closest to sound effects that you really can get. It's the most literal kind of mimicry, you know.
Well, the psycho, you know, violin sound, I guess, that you're getting when she's being stabbed in the shower. Like, that's, you know, that's classic, right?
Exactly.
But it's an instrument. It's not someone screaming. It's not someone making that sound. That's actually music, I guess, of a sort.
Yeah. So that's kind of what's interesting about music. It's like this abstract version of natural sounds. But I liked that those were closer, you know, because some of this mimicry is really abstract. Like in sad music, there's something called the pianto topic, which is essentially just a half step falling motion, like, which is supposed to mimic a sigh. But, you know, that's quite abstract. You can kind of get there, but it's not a direct mimicry. Whereas the psycho violin, you know, sounds very scream-like in a way, although not so much that one, but the contemporary ones, like electronic scores, those really do sound awfully like a scream. So, yeah, I was looking at those in the brain. I was measuring people's, I was using MRI, like I'm doing functional MRI, to see if the brain was processing screams the same as it was processing scream-like music. And we didn't end up publishing these results, partly because I left academia. But what we did find, though, was it was interesting. It reflected kind of what I've already said, that it's sort of an abstract version, and our brain seems to recognize that. Our brain really prioritizes vocal signals. They're super important to the brain because human communication is a really big priority for us as a species. So
the scream, for instance, would really make an impression. I mean, yeah. I imagine it's probably similar to hearing your baby cry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are things in, like, you know, you got to take care of that.
Yes. It's a deep signal in our brain, right? And so we were seeing a stronger reaction, to the screams than to the music. And that sort of makes sense. And there were more intricacies to that, but I can't really remember the exact brain areas and all that. But it was cool to see that, it is sort of mimicking, but our brain really separates them. You know, it may still get sort of a response, a same kind of fearful response, but it's not going to be as powerful as the voice, which makes sense because music is not real, right? Like, there's a difference between a real stimuli and sort of this artistic one. Yeah. So it was interesting.
Yeah. So then, question for you about what it's like moving from academia to industry. Like, did you find them completely different? Were there similarities of any kind?
I think at first it's just pure overwhelm because you just don't understand how anything works in industry.
Okay. Like, yeah.
You know, I just felt like you really feel like you're just going out into a new forest and just have no clue what you're doing. Everything is really formulaic in how academia works, and you just get really used to the value system, kind of how you prioritize, how you sort your work, how you present your work, how you talk about what you do. All of that has to kind of change as you move into industry. So, I mean, what's nice is I was surprised at how valuable everything I had done became in the position that I've created for myself, actually, now. I thought I was going to have to kind of leave my academic stuff behind and start over. I think a lot of academics are scared that's going to happen, that it's going to feel like, I don't know, maybe wasted all that time. I mean, I think that's a pretty sad way to view it because people change careers all the time. It doesn't mean what you did before was wasted. It just means you did something different.
Extra experiences make what you do later on to be even more fulfilling. Yeah.
But I was a bit, I was prepared that I may not be able to continue doing kind of music cognition. And I'm very happy that that hasn't been the case. That was surprising.
So now that you've created your own company and you can let me know how that happened, because sure there was a process for that. Now that you're in your own company, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish?
Okay. So maybe I should say kind of how I got started the company first.
How you got started would be great. Yeah.
Because I think it helps me get into kind of what the goal is. Yeah. So I didn't mean
to ask too much at once.
No, it's okay. It's all right. I just was thinking the smoothest way. So as I mentioned, I got interested in music. Of course I'm interested in music. I got interested in UX research, and I decided to do a certificate in UX research. And just to clarify, I don't know how many listeners you've had or people you've had to talk about UX research. Maybe I should clarify what it is exactly.
I've had a few. User experience, right?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. User experience.
Especially in gaming, actually, because I had someone specifically who did that for gaming. And basically it's the menu items and the things that you change on your screen that you're going to hear multiple times. All of the things that the user experience, that they have to do to get something to function in whatever it is they're in. But there are sounds associated with that, and you have to be very careful about what kind of sounds you put on that, because you're going to hear it a lot. So it can't be annoying. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, gaming UX is huge for gaming.
But I mean, your definition might be different from mine, so by all means.
I think I'm sort of exploring it. I saw something that was really liberating once on LinkedIn about UX, and it was saying that you don't have to restrict it to a certain definition. I don't know. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember that it made me feel like, I can sort of figure out what I want it to be, which is really nice. Because I think what's important is the core of it. It's about user experience. It's about improving people's experience with a product. What that means can really vary, and what kind of product you're talking about. Because usually UX gets pinholed, I mean, and it makes sense because it comes from the tech world, right? It comes from like Apple and these guys, and it's mostly usually about interfaces and how interfaces work and all this. So I do think sometimes there's some confusion about my company. It's something I need to work on, actually, that's all I study is like sounds in that context. But that's not at all the case. In fact, I don't think that's the best thing for me to work on, actually, with qualitative work. I think my research methods are more suited to longer experiences with audio. So soundscapes in like an office, for example, or I recently did a really nice, it was a really fun project on phone trees and on hold music, because that's a kind of a long form audio experience.
Someone who's paying attention to that. Thank you.
I know, I was so excited.
Oh my God. There are so many really bad on hold experiences out there in the world that I am really, really happy to hear that someone's actually making them better.
Yes.
So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
It was funny because they had recruited me for this project. It was a music cognition group, and they were working for a major healthcare company. And they said that the healthcare company really wanted research to inform what they were doing. But then they hadn't thought about the phone tree for that. They just mentioned it. They were like, oh, and we're also doing the phone tree and the on-hold music. And I was like, wait, that would be great for me to work on. And they were like, really? I was like, yeah. I was like, somebody needs to do UX on that. It's the worst. So I was really excited. It was really interesting. And it's something I want to actually really develop and market, is like, I can do this for your phones. Please let me fix your phones.
Yes. So what would you do to fix them? I'm curious, because like I have heard some really, really bad phone trees. And there are telecommunication companies here in Canada that have like monopolies pretty much. There's like two companies that you can choose from, and both of them have not so great on hold. One of them is so bad that it almost sounds like music they recorded from a tape player.
Oh, boy.
And they're just rewinding it and replaying it no matter, you know. And you could be on that line for a half an hour hearing two songs just playing over that super bad. Oh, my God. They're just horrible. I don't know how these companies get away with it.
I know. I was thinking about that, too. I was like, I have to hunt down these companies that are in charge of this and try to convince them to let me fix it. That's my goal in the next year.
Yeah, yeah. Please get in touch with Rogers Communication Canada and tell them, because they need to know.
Awesome. Yeah.
It's horrible.
I know. And it's so funny because it is like, it's such an important audio experience with a brand, right? I mean, it's like there's this great SNL sketch about it where they call a cable company. It's hilarious. And it's just like such a nightmare calling this cable company. And I know there's some motivation to make it bad, because then they won't cancel their cable. That was the whole joke of the show, that episode, that
sketch.
Well,
but you're pissing off people who are already pissed off.
Yeah.
Is that what you want to do?
Exactly.
I think that's a bad idea.
Completely.
I think that's a bad idea, especially for a telecommunications company.
Right. I know. That is so ironic. Yeah.
I know. Yeah.
So how I fix it. So what I did with this company is the first thing was a lit review. So this is kind of where my music cognition skills come in handy in my job, is I'm very used to rifling through academic literature, trying to find what's useful, what's not, summarizing it, you know. What I like about this a lot in my new position, as opposed to working in academia, is I like really synthesizing it in a way that's accessible and not jargony, and really focusing on what does this research tell us about how to design the product. So focusing on a kind of creative result. This is so fun for me, because I never really did that in academia. It was always just about supporting your hypothesis, explaining your results. But now I get to say, you know, this research shows me that we should compose it this way. And that's really fun. I really enjoy that. And it's nice. I have a music background so that I can tap into that as well. You know, I used to do some composing for film. So I know how to talk to composers and musicians, right, about this research. So that worked out super well. So yeah, I did a big lit review on anything I could find that exists on research on hold music and how people perceive it, research on phone tree organization, and I gave them a bunch of design recommendations for that. Also about like audio technical restrictions with phones. Like you said, like often the audio is just awful quality because they haven't thought about that.
Oh my God. It's just horrible. Also, there are little mini advertisements like on hold messages and such that can be little mini advertisements for your company. So did you talk about voice at all or is it all music?
Yeah, we also talked about voice. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking into voice and they've done studies on, you know, the speed it should be at or if there's preference for different genders or different ranges or this kind of thing.
Does it matter what the company is? Like, is there a change depending on what the brand of the company is?
It's a good question. I don't think I found that in my lit review, but I would say that comes out in the next thing that I did, which is I did usability testing with phone trees for this company. And what I did is I recruited participants from the part of the world it was in. It was this company in the Middle East. And I had them call 5 different hospitals with me on a computer, you know, like this, like we're talking now. And they had one task. It was just try to see if they're open on the weekend to book an appointment. And as soon as someone answers, hang up the phone. Very awkwardly hang up. And it was just to give them a goal to go through the phone tree. And after each phone call, we chatted like about how did it go? What did you like? What did you notice? Did you hear the music? And then at the end, we kind of talked about all of them, you know, which ones were the best, which ones are the worst, why. And, you know, did it remind them of any really horrible phone experiences they've had, really great ones? And so this was super helpful at making sure that the guidance was culturally specific for this company, because there were some interesting findings that related to that. Like, I don't pay for minutes. You know, I haven't paid for minutes on my phone in a very long time in the parts of the world I've lived in. And that became a pretty big concern for the people I was interviewing, which was interesting to me. They really didn't want to wait on hold because it was going to cost them money. And I had that's something I wouldn't have thought of, you know, without doing the usability testing. So that was fascinating. Yeah.
This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.